to form the Sangre de Cristo, reversing hue from green to red progressively at sunset. I remember arriving in Los Alamos, McMillan continues, of that first inspection, and it was late in the afternoon. There was a slight snow falling. It was cold, and there were boys and their masters out on the playing field, in shorts. I remarked that they really believed in hardening up the youth. As soon as Grove saw it, he said, in effect, "This is the place." "My two great loves are physics and desert country," Robert Oppenheimer had written a friend once. "It's a pity they can't be combined." Now, they would be. Leo Szilard, urban man, habitué of hotel lobbies, took a different view of the location when he heard about it. "Nobody could think straight in a place like that," he told his Met Lab colleagues. "Everybody who goes there will go crazy." The Corps of Engineers appraisal, prepared on November 21st, describes a large forested site 35 miles by road northwest of Santa Fe, with no gas or oil lines, one-wire Forest Service telephone, average annual precipitation of 18.53 inches, and an annual range of temperatures from negative 12 to 92 Fahrenheit. The land and improvements, including the boys' school with its 60 horses, 2 tractors, 2 trucks, 50 saddles, 800 cords of firewood, 25 tons of coal, and 1,600 books, were worth $440,000. The school was willing to sell. The Manhattan Project acquired its scenic laboratory site. Groves convinced the University of California to serve as contractor to operate the secret installation. Construction of cheap, barracks-like buildings not intended to outlast the war, with coal-burning stoves and no sidewalks on which to escape the mire of spring and autumn mud, began almost immediately. "What we were trying to do," writes John Manley, the University of Illinois physicist working with Oppenheimer then, "was build a new laboratory in the wilds of New Mexico with no initial equipment except the library of Horatio Alger books or whatever it was that those boys in the ranch school read, and the pack equipment that they used going horseback riding, none of which helped us very much in getting neutron-producing accelerators." Robert R. Wilson, a young Berkeley PhD teaching at Princeton, went up to Harvard for Oppenheimer and negotiated with Percy Bridgman for the Harvard cyclotron. Wisconsin would contribute 2 Van de Graaffs. From other laboratories, including Berkeley and the University of Illinois, Manley scavenged other gear. In the meantime, Oppenheimer crisscrossed the country recruiting. The prospect of coming to Los Alamos aroused great misgivings. It was to be a military post. Men were asked to sign up more or less for the duration. Restrictions on travel and on the freedom of families to move about would be severe. The notion of disappearing into the New Mexico desert for an indeterminate period and under quasi-military auspices disturbed a good many scientists, and the families of many more. But there was another side to it. Almost everyone realized that this was a great undertaking. Almost everyone knew that if it were completed successfully and rapidly enough, it might determine the outcome of the war. Almost everyone knew that it was an unparalleled opportunity to bring to bear the basic knowledge and art of science for the benefit of his country. Almost everyone knew that this job, if it were achieved, would be a part of history. This sense of excitement, of devotion, and of patriotism, in the end, prevailed. Most of those with whom I talked came to Los Alamos. One of the most tough-minded, I.I. Robbie, did not. His reasons are revealing. He continued developing radar at the radiation laboratory at MIT. "Oppenheimer wanted me to be the associate director," he told in an interviewer many years later. "I thought it over and turned him down. I said, 'I'm very serious about this war. We could lose it with insufficient radar.'" The Columbia physicist thought radar more immediately important to the defense of his country than the distant prospect of an atomic bomb. Nor did he choose to work full-time, he told Oppenheimer, to make the culmination of 3 centuries of physics a weapon of mass destruction. Oppenheimer responded that he would take a different stand if he thought the atomic bomb would serve as such a culmination. To me, it is primarily the development in time of war of a military weapon of some consequence. Either Oppenheimer had not yet thought his way through to a more millenarian view of the new weapon's implications, or he chose to avoid discussing those implications with Robbie. He asked Robbie only to participate in an inaugural physics conference at Los Alamos in April 1943, and to help convince others, particularly Hans Bethe, to sign on.
Eventually, Robbie would come and go as a visiting consultant, one of the very few exceptions to Groves' compartmentalization and isolation rules.
Oppenheimer talked to the Bethes in Cambridge, in snowy New England, December. They questioned him at length about the life they would be asked to lead. Extracts from his letter of response sketched the invention of an instant community. Laboratory, town, utilities, schools, hospitals, a sort of city manager, city engineer, teachers, MP camp, a laundry, two eating places, a recreation officer, libraries, pack trips, movies, bachelor apartments, a so-called post exchange, a vet, barbers and such like, a cantina where we can have beer and cokes and light lunches. The Bethes' best guarantee of satisfaction, Oppenheimer concluded, is in the great effort and generosity that Groves has brought to setting up this odd community, and in Groves's evident desire to make a real success of it. In general, he is not interested in saving money, but in saving critical materials, in cutting down personnel, and in doing nothing which would attract congressional attention to our hijinks. He chose not to mention the security arrangements, in the development of which he was participating, the perimeter fence, the pass controls, the virtual elimination of telephones. Oppenheimer's idea was one telephone for himself, says Dudley, one for the post commander, and any volume business would go out over a teletype. By March, Teller found Bethe taking a very optimistic view, and there was no need whatever to persuade him to come. Teller felt underemployed in Chicago and was eager to move to the new laboratory. John Manley asked him to write a prospectus to help with recruiting, which Teller sent to Oppenheimer in early January. During the Berkeley summer study, the two men had begun what another participant judged a mental love affair. Teller liked and respected Oppie enormously. He kept wanting to talk about him with others who knew him, kept bringing up his name in conversation. Bethe noticed then, and later, that despite their many outward differences, Teller and Oppenheimer were fundamentally very similar. Teller had an extremely quick understanding of things. So did Oppenheimer. They were also somewhat alike in that their actual production, their scientific publications, did not measure up in any way to their capacity. I think Teller's mental capacity is very high, and so was Oppenheimer's. But on the other hand, their papers, while they included some very good ones, never reached really the top standards. Neither of them ever came up to the Nobel Prize level. I think you just cannot get to that level unless you were somewhat introverted. Luis Alvarez, the 1968 physics Nobel laureate, disagrees, at least where Oppenheimer is concerned. He believes Oppenheimer would have won a Nobel Prize for his astrophysical work if he had lived long enough to see his predictions concerning exotic stellar objects, neutron stars, black holes, confirmed, as they have been, by discovery. Both Oppenheimer and Teller wrote poetry. Oppenheimer pursued literature, as Teller pursued music. And for a time, in 1942 and 1943, the Hungarian apparently admired the older and socially more sophisticated New Yorker and hoped to count him for an ally. As Oppenheimer traveled the country recruiting, he discovered to his surprise that few of his colleagues were attracted to the notion of joining the army. It fell to Robbie and his Rad Lab colleague, Robert F. Bacher, during the weeks before Robbie decided to stay in Cambridge, to lead the revolt. The necessity of scientific autonomy was one crucial reason they cited for resisting militarization. Oppenheimer wrote Conant at the beginning of February 1943, and they insisted as a corollary that although the execution of the security and secrecy measures should be in the hands of the military, the decision as to what measures should be applied must be in the hands of the laboratory. On that point, Oppenheimer concurred. because I believe it is the only way to assure the cooperation and the unimpaired morale of the scientists. The stakes were higher than simply losing Robbie and Bacher, Oppenheimer told Conant. I believe that the solidarity of physicists is such that if these conditions are not met, we shall not only fail to have the men from MIT with us, but that many men who have already planned to join the new laboratory will reconsider their commitments or come with such misgivings as to reduce their usefulness. A rebellion, he concluded, would mean a real delay in our work. Groves had wanted the scientists commissioned as a security measure, and because their work might be hazardous. He was hardly interested in the politics of the question, but delay was unthinkable. He compromised. Conant wrote a letter, co-signed by Groves, that Oppenheimer could use in recruiting. It allowed the new laboratory's civilian administration and civilian staff until the time of hazardous large-scale trials. Then anyone who wanted to stay would have to accept a commission, a provision Groves chose later not to pursue. The Army would administer the community it was building around the laboratory. Laboratory security would be Oppenheimer's responsibility, and he would report to Groves. Robert Oppenheimer thus acquired for Los Alamos what Leo Szilard had not been able to organize in Chicago, scientific freedom of speech. The price the new community paid, a social, but more profoundly a political price, was a guarded barbed wire fence around the town, and a second guarded barbed wire fence around the laboratory itself, emphasizing that the scientists and their families were walled off where knowledge of their work was concerned, not only from the world, but from each other. Several of the European-born were unhappy, Laura Fermi notes, because living inside a fenced area reminded them of concentration camps. The heavy water installation at Vemork in southern Norway became a target of British sabotage operations in the winter of 1942-43. The British had been planning to send in two glider loads of demolition experts, 34 trained volunteers. When Groves requested Allied action soon after his appointment to administer the Manhattan Project, they moved ahead to comply. An advance party of four Norwegian commandos parachuted into the Rjukan area on October 18th to prepare the way. But bad planning and bad weather brought disaster to the gliders on the night of November 19th when they crossed the North Sea from Scotland. Both crashed in Norway, one into a mountainside, and the 14 men who survived the separate disasters were captured by German occupation forces and executed the same day. R.V. Jones, an Oxford protege of Cherwell who was now director of intelligence for the British Air Staff, then had one of the most painful decisions that I had to make, whether to send another demolition party after the first. I reasoned that we had already decided, before the tragedy of the first raid, and therefore free from sentiment, that the heavy plant must be destroyed. Casualties must be expected in war, and so if we were right in asking for the first raid, we were probably right in asking that it be repeated. This time six men, Norwegians native to the region and trained as special forces, parachuted onto a frozen lake 30 miles northwest of Vemork on February 16, 1943, the night of a full moon. Here lay the Hardanger Vidde, one of them, Knut Hokelid, writes of the high plateau that surrounded the lake, the largest, loneliest, and wildest mountain area in northern Europe. The men wore white jumpsuits over British Army uniforms and parachuted with skis, supplies, a shortwave radio, and 18 sets of plastic explosives, one for each of the 18 stainless steel electrolysis cells of the high-concentration plant, which happened to have been designed by a refugee physical chemist, Leif Tronstad, who was now responsible to the Norwegian High Command in London for intelligence and sabotage. Hokelid, a powerfully built mountaineer, says they weathered one of the worst storms I have ever experienced in the mountains, to rendezvous some days later with the four Norwegians of the original advance party, who had been forced to hide out on the barren Hardinger Vida and were malnourished and weak. The new arrivals fattened up their compatriots, while one of them skied on to Ryukan to gather the latest information about the plant. He returned to report minefields laid around the obvious approaches, guards on the suspension bridge that crossed the sheer gorge above the shelf on which the hydrochemical facility was built, but only 15 German soldiers on duty, despite the forewarning of the failed glider attack. The factory itself was fitted with searchlights and guarded with machine guns. The commandos set out mid-evening on Saturday, February 27th, leaving one man behind to guard the radios. They carried cyanide capsules and agreed that if anyone was wounded, he would take his own life rather than allow himself to be captured and risk betraying his comrades. They had camped high on the mountain across the gorge from the plant, which was located to take advantage of the fall of water from the lake that fed it, Tinsio. Halfway down, we sighted our objective for the first time, below us on the other side. The great seven-story factory building bulked large on the landscape. The wind was blowing fairly hard, but nevertheless the hum of the machinery came up to us through the ravine. We understood how the Germans could allow themselves to keep so small a guard there. The Colossus lay like a medieval castle, built in the most inaccessible place, protected by precipices and rivers. They crashed down through soft snow all the way to the bottom of the gorge, crossed the frozen river, climbed up toward the plant on the other side. Above, at the elevation of the shelf, was a seldom-used railroad siding leading into the compound that they hoped the Germans had chosen not to mine. It was a dark night, and there was no moon, Hawkelid remembers. The searchlights were kept turned off, and the high wind drowned all the noise we made. Half an hour before midnight, we came to a snow-covered building 500 yards from Vremork, where we ate a little chocolate and waited for the change of sentries. They divided into two groups, a demolition party and a covering party. We were well-armed, 5 Tommy guns among 9 men, and everyone had a pistol, a knife, and hand grenades. In an hour, time for the sentries to settle, they attacked. Hawkelid in the covering party led the way. With bolt cutters, they snipped the thin little iron chain which barred the way to one of the most important military objectives in Europe. The covering party dispersed to its prearranged positions. Hawkelid and one other man took up posts 20 yards from the Wehrmacht barracks, a flimsy wooden building they saw they could easily shoot through, and the demolition party moved ahead. The doors on the ground floor of the plant were locked, but Tronstadt in London had identified for the commandos a cable intake that they could crawl along that led directly to the heavy water facility. 2 men looked for some other entrance, while 2 disappeared into the cable intake. After what seemed to Hawkelid an interminable delay, he heard an explosion. But an astonishingly small, insignificant one. Was this what we had come over 1,000 miles to do? The guards were slow to check. Only 1 German soldier appeared and seemed not to realize what had happened. He tried the doors to the plant, found them locked, looked to see if snow falling from the mountain above had detonated a landmine, and returned to his quarters. The Norwegians moved out fast. They had descended to the river before the sirens began to sound. The operation was successful. No one was injured on either side. All 18 cells had been blown open, spilling nearly 0.5 ton of heavy water into the drains. Not only would the plant require weeks to repair, because it was a cascade, pumping water of increasing deuterium concentration from one cell to the next, it would need almost a year of operation after repair simply to reach equilibrium again on its own and begin producing. General Nicholas von Falkenhorst, the commander-in-chief of the occupying German army in Norway, called the Vremork attack the best coup I have ever seen. Whatever German physicists might be doing with heavy water, they would do it more slowly now. In Japan, both the Army and Air Force and the Imperial Navy had moved separately since 1941 to promote atomic bomb research. The RIKEN, Yoshio Nishina's prestigious Tokyo laboratory, primarily served the Army, exploring the theoretical possibilities of U-235 separation by way of the gaseous barrier diffusion, gaseous thermal diffusion, electromagnetic and centrifuge processes. In the spring of 1942, the Navy committed itself to developing nuclear power for propulsion. The study of nuclear physics is a national project. Research in this field is continuing on a broad scale in the United States, which has recently obtained the services of a number of Jewish scientists, and considerable progress has been made. The objective is the creation of tremendous amounts of energy through nuclear fission. Should this research prove successful, it would provide a stupendous and dependable source of power, which could be used to activate ships and other large pieces of machinery. Although it is not expected that nuclear energy will be realized in the near future, the possibility of it must not be ignored. The Imperial Navy, accordingly, hereby affirms its determination to foster and assist studies in this field. Soon after that non-violent affirmation, however, the Naval Technological Research Institute appointed a secret committee of leading Japanese scientists, corresponding to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences Committee, to meet monthly to follow research progress until it could report decisively for or against a Japanese atomic bomb. The committee included Nishina, who was forthwith elected chairman. An elderly appointee was Hantanaro Nagaoka, whose Saturnian atomic model had nearly anticipated Ernest Rutherford's planetary model in the early years of the century. The Navy Committee met first on July 8th with the Navy's chief technical officers at an officers' club at Shiba Park in Tokyo. It noted that the United States was probably working on a bomb and agreed that whether and how soon Japan could produce such a weapon was as yet uncertain. To the task of answering those questions, the Navy appropriated 2,000 yen, about $4,700, somewhat less than the Uranium Committee had summoned from the U.S. Treasury at Edward Teller's request at the beginning of the American program in 1939. Nishina hardly participated in the Navy Committee meetings. The fact that he was already working for the Army probably constrained him. The two services, both of which were responsible directly to the Emperor without detour through the civilian government, operated far more independently than their American counterparts and were increasingly bitter rivals. Nishina was coming to conclusions of his own, however, and at the end of 1942, when the Navy Committee began to report discouragement, he met privately with a young cosmic ray physicist in his laboratory, Tadashi Takeuchi, told his young colleague he meant to carry forward isotope separation studies, and asked him to help. Takeuchi agreed. Between December 1942 and March 1943, the Navy Committee organized a 10-session physics colloquium to work through to a decision. By then it was understood that a bomb would necessitate locating, mining, and processing hundreds of tons of uranium ore, and that U-235 separation would require a tenth of the annual Japanese electrical capacity and half the nation's copper output. The colloquium concluded that while an atomic bomb was certainly possible, Japan might need 10 years to build one. The scientists believed that neither Germany nor the United States had sufficient spare industrial capacity to produce atomic bombs in time to be of use in the war. After the final March 6th meeting, the Navy representative at the colloquium reported discouragement. The best minds of Japan, studying the subject from the point of view of their respective fields of endeavor as well as from that of national defense, came to a conclusion that can only be regarded as correct. The more they considered and discussed the problem, the more pessimistic became the atmosphere of the meeting. As a result, the Navy dissolved the committee and asked its members to devote themselves to more immediately valuable research, particularly radar. Nishina continued isotope studies for the Army, deciding on March 19th to focus on thermal diffusion as the only practical separation technology at a time of increasing national shortages. He spoke to his staff of processing several hundred tons of uranium after first building laboratory-scale diffusion apparatus. He envisioned a major program run in parallel, as the Manhattan Project was beginning to be, with weapon design and development proceeding simultaneously with U-235 production. Meanwhile, a different branch of the Navy, the Fleet Administration Center, sponsored a new project in atomic bomb development at the University of Kyoto, where Tokutarō Hagiwara had made his startling early prediction of the possibility of a thermonuclear explosive. The university won support in 1943 to the extent of 600,000 yen, nearly $1.5 million, much of which it budgeted to build a cyclotron. Robert Oppenheimer moved to Santa Fe with a small team of aides on March 15, 1943, brisk, early spring. Scientists and their families arrived by automobile and train during the next 4 weeks. Not much was ready on the mesa, which they began to call the Hill. Groves wanted no breaches of security in the lobbies of Santa Fe hotels. The Army commandeered guest ranches in the area for quarters suitably remote, and brought up Santa Fe's feeble stock of used cars and jitneys to serve as transportation through ruts and mud up and down the terrifying, unbarricaded dirt switchback of the Mesa Access Road. After flat tires and mirings, hours could be short on the hill. Box lunches assembled in Santa Fe gave cold comfort when the delivery truck made it through. The hardships only mattered because they slowed the work. Oppenheimer had sold it as work that would end the war to end all wars, and his people believed him. The unit of measurement for wasted hours was therefore human lives. Construction crews unwilling to vary the specifications of a laboratory door or hang an unauthorized shelf initially bore the brunt of the scientists' impatience. John Manley remembers inspecting the chemistry and physics building. It needed a basement at one end for an accelerator and a solid foundation at the other end for the two Van de Graaffs, which end for which was unimportant. Rather than adjust the construction plans for terrain, the contractor had drilled the basement from solid rock and used the rock debris as fill for the foundation. This was my first introduction to the Army engineers. Fuller Lodge, a ranch school hall elegantly assembled of monumental hand-hewn logs, was kept to serve as a dining room and guest house. The pond south of the lodge, predictably named Ashley Pond after the ranch school's founder, offered winter ice skating and summer canoeing and the easeful harmonic wakes of swimming ducks. The engineers preserved the stone ice house beside the pond that the school had used to store winter cuttings of ice and the row of tree-shaded faculty residences northeast of the lodge. Across the dirt main road that divided the mesa south of the pond, the tech area went up in a style the Army called modified mobilization. Plain, one-story buildings like elongated barracks with clapboard sides and shingled roofs. T buildings would house Oppenheimer and his staff and the theoretical physics division. Behind T, connected by a covered walkway, would be the much longer chemistry and physics building with its Van de Graaffs. Behind that, the laboratory shops. Farther south, near the rim of the mesa above Los Alamos Canyon, contractors would hammer up a cryogenics laboratory and the building that would shelter Harvard's cyclotron. West and north of the tech area, the first two-story, four-unit family apartments, painted drab green, urbanized last year's pastures and fields. More apartments and dormitories for the unmarried would follow. At the beginning of April, Oppenheimer assembled the scientific staff. About 30 persons at that point of the 100 scientists initially hired, says Emilio Segre, who was one among them, for a series of introductory lectures. Robert Serber, thin and shy, delivered the lectures with authority despite the distraction of a lisp. They summed up the conclusions of the Berkeley summer study and incorporated the experimental fast fission work of the past year. Edward U. Condon, the crew-cut Alamogordo-born theoretician from Westinghouse, whom Oppenheimer had chosen for associate director, revised his notes of Serber's lecture into the new laboratory's first report, a document called the Los Alamos Primer, that was subsequently handed to all new tech area arrivals cleared for secret limited access. In 24 mimeographed pages, the primer defined the laboratory's program to build the first atomic bombs. Serber's lectures startled the chemists and experimental physicists, whom compartmentalization had kept in the dark. The scientists' euphoria at finally learning in detail what they had only previously guessed or heard hinted measures the extent to which secrecy had contorted their emotional commitment to the work. Now, following the lead of their mentors. Their average age was 25. Oppenheimer, Bethe, Teller, Macmillan, Bacher, Segre, and Condon were older men. They could apply themselves at last with devotion. In that heady new freedom, they seldom noticed the barbed wire. Similarly confined but kept uninformed because Oppenheimer and Groves decided it so, the wives served harder time. The object of the project, Condon summarizes what Serber told the scientists, is to produce a practical military weapon in the form of a bomb in which the energy is released by a fast neutron chain reaction in one or more of the materials known to show nuclear fission. Serber said 1 kilogram of U-235 was approximately equal to 20,000 tons of TNT, and noted that nature had almost located that conversion beyond human meddling. Since only the last few generations of the chain reaction will release enough energy to produce much expansion of the critical mass, it is just possible for the reaction to occur to an interesting extent before it is stopped by the spreading of the active material. If fission had proceeded more energetically, the bombs would have slept forever in the dark beds of their ores. Serber discussed fission cross-sections, the energy spectrum of secondary neutrons, the average number of secondary neutrons per fission, measured by then to be about 2.2, the neutron captures process in U-238 that led to plutonium, and why ordinary uranium is safe. It would have to be enriched to at least 7% U-235, the young theoretician pointed out, to make an explosive reaction possible. He was already calling the bomb the Gadget, its nickname thereafter on the Hill, a bravado metonymy that Oppenheimer probably coined. The calculations Serber reported indicated a critical mass for metallic U-235 tamped with a thick shell of ordinary uranium of 15 kilograms, 33 pounds. For plutonium, similarly tamped, the critical mass might be 5 kilograms, 11 pounds. The heart of their atomic bomb would then be a cantaloupe of U-235 or an orange of Pu-239, surrounded by a watermelon of ordinary uranium tamper, the combined diameter of the two nested spheres about 18 inches. Shaped of such heavy metal, the tamper would weigh about a ton. The critical masses would eventually have to be determined by actual test, Serber said. He went on to speak of damage. Out to a radius of 1,000 yards around the point of explosion, the area would be drenched with neutrons, enough to produce severe pathological effects. That would render the area uninhabitable for a time. It was clear by now, it had not been clear before, that a nuclear explosion would be no less damaging than an equivalent chemical explosion. Since the one factor that determines the damage is the energy release, our aim is simply to get as much energy from the explosion as we can. And since the materials we use are very precious, we are constrained to do this with as high an efficiency as is possible. Efficiency appeared to be a serious problem. The reaction will not go to completion in an actual gadget. Untamped, a bomb core, even as large as twice the critical mass, would completely fission less than 1% of its nuclear material before it expanded enough to stop the chain reaction from proceeding. An equally disadvantageous secondary effect also tended to stop the reaction. As the pressure builds up, it begins to blow off material at the outer edge of the core. Tamper always increased efficiency. It reflected neutrons back into the core and its inertia, not its tensile strength, which was inconsequential at the pressures a chain reaction would generate, slowed the core's expansion and helped keep the core's surface from blowing away. But even with a good tamper, they would need more than one critical mass per bomb for reasonable efficiency. Detonation was equally a problem. To detonate their bombs, they would have to rearrange the core material so that its effective neutron number, which corresponded to Fermi's K, changed from less than 1 to more than 1. But however they rearranged the material, firing one subcritical piece into another subcritical piece inside the barrel of a cannon seemed to be the simplest option, they would have no slow, smooth transition as Fermi had with CP1. if they fired one piece into another at the high velocity of 3,000 feet per second, it would take the pieces about a thousandth of a second to assemble themselves. But since more than one critical mass was necessary for an efficient explosion, the pieces would be supercritical before they had completely mated. If a stray neutron then started a chain reaction, the resulting inefficient explosion would proceed from beginning to end in a few millionths of a second. An explosion started by a premature neutron will be all finished before there is time for the pieces to move an appreciable distance. Which meant that the neutron background, spontaneous fission neutrons from the tamper, neutrons knocked from light element impurities, neutrons from cosmic rays, would have to be kept as low as possible, and the rearrangement of the core material managed as fast as possible. On the other hand, they did not have to worry that a fizzle would drop an intact bomb into enemy hands. Even a fizzle would release energy equivalent to at least 60 tons of TNT. Pre-detonation would reduce the bomb's efficiency, Serber repeated. So also might post-detonation. When the pieces reach their best position, we want to be very sure that a neutron starts the reaction before the pieces have a chance to separate and break. So there might be a third basic component to their atomic bomb besides nuclear core and confining tamper. An initiator, a Ra plus Be source, or better, a Po plus Be source, with the radium or polonium attached perhaps to one piece of the core and the beryllium to the other, to smash together and spray neutrons when the parts mated to start the chain reaction. Firing the pieces of the core together, the Berkeley theoretician continued, is the part of the job about which we know least at present. The Summers study group had examined several ingenious designs. The most favorable fired a cylindrical male plug of core and tamper into a mated female sphere of tamper and core. The target sphere could be simply welded to the muzzle of a cannon. Then the cylinder, which might weigh about 100 pounds, could be fired up the barrel like a shell. The highest muzzle velocity available in U.S. Army guns is one whose bore is 4.7 inches and whose barrel is 21 feet long. This gives a 50-pound projectile a muzzle velocity of 3,150 feet per second. The gun weighs 5 tons. It appears that the ratio of projectile mass to gun mass is about constant for different guns, so a 100-pound projectile would require a gun weighing about 10 tons. For a mechanism 8 times lighter, or with double the effective muzzle velocity, they could weld 2 guns together at their muzzles and fire 2 projectiles into each other. Synchronization would be a problem with such a design, and efficiency might require 4 critical masses instead of 2, a demand which would significantly delay delivering a usable bomb. Serber also described more speculative arrangements, sliced ellipsoidal core tamper assemblies like halves of hard-boiled eggs that slid together, wedge-shaped quarters of core tamper like sections of a quartered apple mounted on a ring. That was an odd and striking design, sketched in the mimeographed primer as probably on a blackboard before, and it did not go unnoticed. If explosive material were distributed around the ring and fired, the pieces would be blown inward to form a sphere. Autocatalytic bombs, bombs in which the chain reaction itself, as it proceeded, increased the neutron number for a time, looked less promising. The cleverest notion incorporated bubbles of boron-coated paraffin into the U-235 core. As the core expanded, it would compress the neutron-absorbing boron and render it less efficient, freeing more neutrons for fission chains. But all autocatalytic schemes that have been thought of so far require large amounts of active material, are low in efficiency unless very large amounts are used, and are dangerous to handle. Some bright ideas are needed. Their immediate work of experiment, Serber concluded, would be measuring the neutron properties of various materials and mastering the ordnance problem, the problem, that is, of assembling a critical mass and firing the bomb. They would also have to devise a way to measure a critical mass for fast fission with subcritical amounts of U-235 and PU-239. They had a deadline, workable bombs ready when enough uranium and plutonium was ready. That probably gave them 2 years. The Japanese Physics Colloquium in Tokyo had decided in March 1943 that an atomic bomb was possible, but not practically attainable by any of the belligerents in time to be of use in the present war. Robert Serber's lectures at Los Alamos in early April asserted to the contrary, that for the United States, an atomic bomb was both possible and probably attainable within 2 years. The Japanese assessment was essentially technological. Like Bohr's assessment in 1939, it overestimated the difficulty of isotope separation and underestimated U.S. industrial capacity. It also, as the Japanese government had before Pearl Harbor, underestimated American dedication. Collective dedication was a pattern of Japanese culture more than of American, but Americans could summon it when challenged and couple it with resources of talent and capital unmatched anywhere else in the world. The Europeans at Los Alamos complained of the barbed wire, with the exception apparently only of Edward Condon, who found security so oppressive he quit the project within weeks of his arrival and went back to Westinghouse. The Americans accepted the fences around their work and their lives as a necessity of war. The war was a manifestation of nationalism, not of science, and such did their duty on the Hill appear at first to be. There was relatively little nuclear physics at Los Alamos, Betha says, mostly cross-section calculations. They thought they were assembled to engineer a practical military weapon. That was first of all a national goal. Science, a fragile, nascent political system of limited but increasing franchise, would have to wait until the war was won. Or so it seemed. But a few among the men and women gathered at Los Alamos, certainly Robert Oppenheimer, sniffed a paradox. They proposed, in fact, to win the war with an application of their science. They dreamed further that by that same application they might forestall the next war, might even end war as a means of settling differences between nations, which must, in the long run, have decisive consequences, one way or the other, for nationalism. By the time Robert Serber finished his orientation lectures at Los Alamos in mid-April, most of the scientific and technical staff was on hand. Many lodged temporarily in the surviving buildings of the ranch school. Now began a second phase of the conference, to plan the laboratory's work. If there were any groundbreaking ceremonies at Los Alamos, like champagne or cutting ribbons, John Manley comments, I was unaware of them. Most of us who were there felt that the conference in April 1943 was really the groundbreaking ceremony. Robbie, Fermi, and Samuel Allison arrived from Cambridge and Chicago to serve as senior consultants. Groves appointed a review committee. W.K. Lewis, again, an engineer named E.L. Rose, who was thoroughly experienced in ordnance design, Von Vleck, Tolman, and one other expert to follow planning and advise. Groves, despite his formidable competence as an organizer and administrator, was intellectually insecure around so many distinguished scientists, as who would not be? They laid their plans, often during hikes into the uninhabited wild surroundings of the mesa. They had to rely heavily on theoretical anticipations of the effects they wanted to study. That was their basic constraint. Any experimental device that demonstrated a fast neutron chain reaction to completion would use up at least one critical mass. There could be no controlled, laboratory-scale bomb tests, no squash-court demonstrations. They decided they had to analyze the explosion theoretically and work out ways to calculate the stages of its development. They needed to understand how neutrons would diffuse through the core and the tamper. They needed a theory of the explosion's hydrodynamics, the complex dynamic motions of its fluids, which the core and tamper would almost instantly become as their metals heated from solid to liquid to gas. They needed detailed experiments to observe bomb-related nuclear phenomena, and they needed integral experiments to duplicate as much as possible the full-scale operation of the bomb. They had to develop an initiator to start the chain reaction. They had to devise technology for reducing uranium and plutonium to metal, for casting and shaping that metal, possibly for alloying it to improve its properties. Particularly with plutonium, they had to discover and measure those properties in the first place, and do so quickly when more than microgram quantities began to arrive. As a sideline, because they agreed that work on the super should continue at second priority, they wanted to construct and operate a plant for liquefying deuterium at negative 429 degrees Fahrenheit, the cryogenics plant to be built near the south rim of the mesa. Ordnance work was crucial. From the April discussions came immediate breakthroughs. An Oppenheimer recruit from the National Bureau of Standards, who had been a protege at Caltech, a tall, thin, 36-year-old experimental physicist named Seth Nettermeyer, imagined an entirely different strategy of assembly. Nettermeyer could not quite remember after the war the complex integrations by which he came to it. An ordnance expert had been lecturing. The expert had quibbled at the physicist's use of the word explosion to describe firing the bomb parts together. The proper word, the expert said, was implosion. During Serber's lectures, Nettermeyer had already been thinking about what must happen when a heavy cylinder of metal is fired into a blind hole in an even heavier metal sphere. Spheres and shock waves made him think about spherically symmetrical shock waves, whatever those might be. I remember thinking of trying to push in a shell of material against a plastic flow, Nettermeyer told an interviewer later, and I calculated the minimum pressures that would have to be applied. Then I happened to recall a crazy thing somebody had published about firing bullets against each other. It may have had a photograph of two bullets liquefied on impact. That is what I was thinking when the ballistics man mentioned implosion. Two bullets fired against each other recall the double-gun model of the Los Alamos primer. There were other clues to Nettermeyer's new strategy placed evocatively in the primer as well. That document notes that when the surface of the bomb core blows off, it expands into the tamper material, starting a shockwave which compresses the tamper material 16-fold. The primer emphasizes more than once that the expansion of the core would be the greatest obstacle to an efficient explosion. It may have occurred to Nettermeyer that if a tamper, merely by its inertia, by its tendency to stay where it is when the swelling core begins to push out against it, could resist the core's expansion, and thereby increase the efficiency of the explosion, a tamper that somehow pushed back against the core might do even better. The compressing of the boron bubbles in the autocatalytic bomb may also have been suggestive. Finally, the primer offered the interesting model of four apple quarter wedges of core tamper fired together by an encompassing explosive ring. At this point, says Nettermeyer, I raise my hand. He proposed packing a spherical layer of high explosives around a spherical assembly of tamper and a hollow but thick-walled spherical core. Detonated at many points simultaneously, the HE would blow inward. The shock wave from that explosion would squeeze the tamper from all sides, which in turn would squeeze the core. Squeezing the core would change its geometry from hollow shell to solid ball. What had been subcritical because of its geometry would be squeezed critical far faster and more efficiently than any mere gun could fire. The gun will compress in one dimension, Manley remembers Nettermeyer telling them. Two dimensions would be better. Three dimensions would be better still. A three-dimensional squeeze inward was implosion. Nettermeyer had just defined a possible new way to fire an atomic bomb. The idea had been suggested previously, but no one had carried it beyond conversation. At a meeting on ordnance problems late in April, records the Los Alamos Technical History, Nettermeyer presented the first serious theoretical analysis of the implosion. His arguments showed that the compression of a sphere by detonation of a surrounding high-explosive layer was feasible, and that it would be superior to the gun method both in its high velocity and shorter path of assembly. The response at the time was not encouraging.
Neddermeyer faced stiff opposition from Oppenheimer, and I think Fermi and Bethe, Manley says. How do you make a shockwave spherically symmetrical? How do you keep tamper and core from squirting out in every direction, as water does when squeezed between cupped hands? Nobody really took implosion very seriously, Manley adds. But Oppenheimer had been wrong before, even about the possibility of fission, when Luis Alvarez dropped by to report it in 1939. Wrong for the 15 minutes it took him to think past the stubbornness with which he rejected any possibility he had not himself foreseen. Apparently, he was learning to steer by that grudging incredulity, as Bohr steered by the madness of a truly original idea. "This will have to be looked into," he told Neddermeyer in private conference after the dismissive public debate. He took his revenge for the trouble Neddermeyer was causing him by appointing that thoroughgoing loner to the newly invented post of group leader in the Ordnance Division for implosion experimentation. The other fresh insight remembered from the April conference corrected an error that everyone wondered afterward how anyone could have overlooked. The error is perhaps a measure of how unfamiliar the physicists were with ordnance. E.L. Rose, the research engineer on Groves's review committee, woke up one day to realize that the Army cannon the physicists were basing their estimates on weighed 5 tons only because it had to be sturdy enough for repeated firing. A gun that wore an atomic bomb welded to its muzzle could be flimsier. It would be fired only once, after which it would vaporize and drift away. That specification cut its weight drastically and promised a practical, flyable bomb. Fermi, superb experimentalist that he was, contributed valuably to the program of experimental studies, defining with clarity problems that needed to be examined. For him, the war work was duty, however, and the eager conviction he found on the Hill puzzled him. After he had sat in on one of his first conferences here, Oppenheimer recalls, he turned to me and said, "I believe your people actually want to make a bomb." I remember his voice sounded surprised. The leaders attended a party one night that April at Oppenheimer's house, the log and stucco former residence of the ranch school headmaster. Edward Condon, whose father had been a builder of railroads in the West, who had worked as a newspaper reporter in tough Oakland, found occasion at Oppenheimer's party to satirize Los Alamos's Panglossian mood. He was an exceptional theoretician. He and Oppenheimer had boarded together at Göttingen. Condon thought they were fast friends. He would soon clash bitterly with Groves over compartmentalization and find that his friend, the director, had higher priorities than backing him up. Now, sitting in a corner at the director's house, Condon pulled from a bookshelf a copy of Shakespeare's The Tempest and skimmed it for speeches meant for Prospero's enchanted island that might play contrapuntally against Oppenheimer's high and dry and secret mesa where no one had a street address, where mail was censored, where driver's licenses went nameless, where children would be born and families live and a few people die behind a post office box in devotion to the cause of harnessing an obscure force of nature to build a bomb that might end a brutal war. There are many speeches in The Tempest that would have fit the occasion, but one certainly that Condon would not have missed reading aloud to the assembled, Miranda's speech that Aldous Huxley borrowed for an ironic title. "Oh, wonder, how many goodly creatures are there here? How beauteous mankind is! Oh, brave new world that has such people in it!" The British had chosen not to bomb Vemork because Leif Tronstad, the physical chemist attached to Norwegian intelligence in London, had warned that hitting the hydrochemical facility's liquid ammonia storage tanks would almost certainly kill large numbers of Norwegian workers. But the British had, in any case, long since abandoned precision bombing. Winston Churchill had declared himself strongly in favor of strategic air attacks early in the war, speaking even of extermination. In July 1940, in the desperate time after the debacle of Dunkirk and at the beginning of the Battle of Britain, Churchill had written his Minister of Aircraft Production to that effect.
But when I look round to see how we can win the war, I see that there is only one sure path, and that is absolutely devastating, exterminating attack by very heavy bombers from this country upon the Nazi homeland. We must be able to overwhelm them by this means, without which I do not see a way through. The slide from precision bombing attacks on industry to general attacks on cities followed less from political decisions than from inadequate technology. Bomber Command had attempted long-distance daylight precision bombing early in the war, but had been unable to defend its aircraft against German fighters and flak so far from home. It therefore switched to night bombing, which reduced losses, but severely impaired accuracy. If it was logical to bomb factories and other strategic targets to reduce the enemy's ability to wage war, it began to seem equally logical to bomb the blocks of workers' housing that surrounded those targets. The workers, after all, made the factories run. Sir Arthur Harris, who became chief of Bomber Command in early 1942, notes in his war memoirs of this transitional period in the summer of 1941 that the targets chosen were in congested industrial areas and were carefully picked so that bombs which overshot or undershot the actual railway centers under attack, in this instance, should fall on these areas, thereby affecting morale. This program amounted to a halfway stage between area and precision bombing. Morale is here and elsewhere in the literature of air power a euphemism for the bombing of civilians. Another sign of halfway status at this stage was permission to dump bombs before exiting Germany if crews had missed their targets. Churchill says he authorized a study of bombing accuracy at Frederick Lindemann's suggestion, which discovered in the summer of 1941 that, although Bomber Command believed they had found the target, two-thirds of crews actually failed to strike within 5 miles of it. Unless we could improve on this, there did not seem much use in continued night bombing. In November, the government ordered its bomber arm to reduce operations over Germany. To reduce strategic bombing operations was to admit failure in both theory and practice, and it was to do so at a time when the USSR was fully engaged with the German armies on the Eastern Front and Joseph Stalin was demanding the Allies open a second front in the West. Neither Britain nor the United States was nearly prepared yet to invade Europe on the ground. But both nations might offer such aid as air attack could bring. Aiding the Soviet Union was a political justification for continuing some kind of strategic bombing campaign, though it hardly placated Stalin. Headlines proclaiming almost daily bombing raids also helped keep the home front happy when the ground war stalled. Yet Allied politics and domestic propaganda could not have been the primary reasons for the drift from precision to area bombing, because U.S. air forces beginning to arrive in Britain in 1942 planned and carried out precision daylight bombing, though not often effectively, until much later in the war. Rather, Bomber Command switched programs in order to justify its continued existence as a service with a mission separate from Army and Navy tactical support, cutting theory to fit the facts. It found an ally in the newly ennobled Lindemann, Lord Cherwell, who calculated in March 1942 that bombing might destroy the housing of a third of the German population within a year if sufficiently pursued against industrial urban areas. Patrick Blackett and Henry Tizard thought Cherwell's estimate far too optimistic and dissented vigorously. But Cherwell had the Prime Minister's ear. Sir Arthur Harris, Butch, his staff came to call him, short for the Butcher, took over Bomber Command in February and promulgated a new approach to the air war. It has been decided that the primary objective of your operations should now be focused on the morale of the enemy's civil population, and in particular of the industrial workers. Harris had witnessed the London Blitz. It convinced him, he writes, that a bomber offensive of adequate weight and the right kind of bombs would, if continued for long enough, be something that no country in the world could endure. His argument was valid, of course, though what the right kind of bombs might be would require the work of the Manhattan Project to reveal. Hitler's terror bombing taught Britain not terror, but forceful imitation. Harris certainly despised the Germans for starting and perpetuating two world wars, but he seems to have thought less about killing civilians than about solving the problem of making Bomber Command a measurably effective force. If night bombing and area bombing were the only tactics that paid a reasonable return in destruction at a reasonable price in lost aircraft and aircrew lives, then he would dedicate Bomber Command to perfecting those tactics, and measure success not in factories rendered inoperative, but in acres of cities flattened. Which is to say, area bombing was invented to give bombers targets they could hit. An incendiary attack on the old Baltic port of Lübeck in March burned much of the town and produced four-figure casualties for the first time in the bombing campaign. On May 20th, to demonstrate Bomber Command's effectiveness at a time of public debate, Harris mustered every aircraft he could find, hundreds of two-engine bombers of light payload, and even training planes, to launch a 1,000-bomber raid on Cologne. For that successful assault, he organized what came to be called a bomber stream, the aircraft flying in massed, continuous formations to overwhelm defenses rather than in small and vulnerable packets as before, and destroyed some 8 square miles of the ancient city on the Rhine with 1,400 tons of bombs, two-thirds of them incendiary. Finally, in August, encouraged by Cherwell, Bomber Command deployed a Pathfinder force, skilled advance crews that marked targets with colored flares so that less experienced pilots following in the lethal stream could more easily find their aiming points. No fleet of bombers could yet accurately deliver enough high explosives to raise a city. The Lübeck bombing had been planned to test the theory that area bombing worked best by starting fires. If the bomb loads were incendiary, then the massed aircraft might combine their destructiveness, wind and weather cooperating, rather than disperse it on isolated targets. The theory worked at Lübeck and again at Cologne, and because it worked, it won adoption. At the end of 1942, the British chiefs of staff called for the progressive destruction and dislocation of the enemy's war, industrial, and economic system, and the undermining of his morale to a point where his capacity for armed resistance is fatally weakened. Churchill and Roosevelt affirmed the British plan for an aerial war of attrition in a directive issued at the conclusion of the Casablanca Conference in late January 1943. On May 27, 1943, as work began at Los Alamos following the April conferences, Bomber Command ordered Hamburg attacked. Its Most Secret Operation Order No. 173 stated its new policy of mass destruction explicitly. Information. The importance of Hamburg, the second largest city in Germany with a population of 1.5 million, is well known. The total destruction of this city would achieve immeasurable results in reducing the industrial capacity of the enemy's war machine. This, together with the effect on German morale, which would be felt throughout the country, would play a very important part in shortening and in winning the war. 2. The Battle of Hamburg cannot be won in a single night. It is estimated that at least 10,000 tons of bombs will have to be dropped to complete the process of elimination. This city should be subjected to sustained attack. 3. It is hoped that the night attacks will be preceded and or followed by heavy daylight attacks by the United States 8th Bomber Command. Intention? 4. To destroy Hamburg. The operation was codenamed Gomorra. Notice the significant claim that it would help shorten and win the war. Operation Gomorra began on the night